Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good Monday morning. This is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up today, what nonprofits do when it turns out one of their donors is in trouble, and preparing Phoenicians for the jobs of the future and automation.
We start this morning with immigration raids that never happened, at least not on the scale previously announced. The White House said last week that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, would detain 2,000 people Sunday ordered removed by immigration courts. But the 10 cities targeted, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City, saw minimal activity by immigration agents. Cindy Carcamo reports on immigration for the Los Angeles Times and is with us. Cindy, let's begin with the expectations. What were the best and worst-case scenarios when it comes to what people were expecting?
Sure. Well, the expectation was that there were going to be about 2,000, maybe upward of 2,000 apprehensions, and these would be targeted toward people who have final removal orders and recent arrivals. But there was a lot of confusion about who would actually be targeted. And when you think about that number, 2,000, it's statistically minuscule compared to the amount of people who are in this country with final removal orders, which is about 1 million.
So we had approximately 10 cities that at least we thought were going to be targets, some large cities like Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco. How did any of that actually play out in terms of what was actually accomplished?
Yes. Well, I mean, the administration would say that this is just the beginning, right? That it was supposed to start on Sunday and it's going to go through the week. So there's still some time. But really, if we're looking at the beginning being Sunday, it went off with a whimper. Like, there were reports of scattered, you know, apprehensions here and there, or actually like unsuccessful. In New York, there were two cases where they were trying to apprehend people and they weren't successful at doing so. So you heard, you know, rumors also of apprehensions here and there, but really when it really came down to it, by the end of the day on Sunday, it really went off with a whimper.
To what extent is this having a chilling effect on certain immigrant communities in some of these areas? Were people trying to go other places? Were they not answering their doors? That kind of thing.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, initially I thought that at least a lot in Los Angeles, for instance, or in California, that people would kind of still go on with their lives. And then maybe in other areas of the country where immigration customs enforcement has more free rein, that people would be more scared. But actually, I was wrong. I was proven wrong. And the minute I woke up on Sunday morning, it was a message from some from a source that I have who's in the country with actually a visa, and he's been here for a bit. And he was asking me, hey, can you tell me, you know, had the raid started? I mean, he was very, very worried. He was sending me text messages and asking, trying to get as much information from me. And I was surprised. And he said, we're not going to be leaving the house today. And we're ordering in meals. His brother is in the country without legal status. He came in undetected. So Immigration and Customs Enforcement probably doesn't even know that he's in the country, but they're still scared because they'd heard about the collateral arrests as well. So people were really hunkering down. I was surprised. I also went out to Calle Cuatro, 4th Street here in Santa Ana yesterday to see what was going on. And usually on a Sunday, especially after church, you have people, you know, gathering around, especially the vendors and the fruit carts and everything. And there weren't as many people at all. And I spoke with the street vendors and they were telling me that, you know, business was down by half. So it definitely had a chilling effect. And the gentleman who I spoke with, who was texting me in the morning, he planned to take the whole week off work. He's that scared, even though he has a visa and he doesn't have a removal order, he's still afraid.
Cindy, finally, many have talked about the politics of this, that perhaps this cements President Trump's base. And even the new communications director, Stephanie Grisham, had a quote this weekend: I take an issue with the word raids. These are law enforcement officials carrying out law enforcement operations they've done in the past and will continue to do. Where does this all fit in the political spectrum as far as what people are saying about it?
What people are saying about it, immigration experts, people who have been watching this and who have been, following this for quite some time now, if you really think about it, the apprehension numbers, the goal was 2,000, very small compared. I mean, it's horrible for those 2,000 people, but it's very small compared to how many actual removal orders there are in the country, which is nearly a million. But it doesn't really matter. The numbers really don't matter anymore, especially in this administration. I think it's the message, right? This kind of psychological warfare and just psychology in general, where you're sending messages to two groups of people, really. So first, you're sending a message, Trump is sending a message to his base, saying, look, I'm actually doing something. And the second is sending a message to people who are in the country without legal status, or just immigrants in general. I mean, you have people who are here with legal status who are scared as well. And telling them, be fearful and maybe you should leave. Even before any one apprehension was made over the weekend, or any one apprehension is going to be made going forward, I think Trump's already kind of won that game.
That is Cindy Carcamo. She covers immigration issues for the Los Angeles Times. Cindy, great to talk with you this morning. Thanks for the insights.
Thank you for having me on.
There are more details about disturbing allegations involving children at an Arizona immigration detention facility. Customs and Border Protection is investigating claims of abuse of migrant children that is alleged to go beyond mistreatment.
In a story uncovered by NBC News last week, a 15-year-old girl from Honduras reported that an immigration officer at a Yuma detention facility allegedly groped her in front of other officers. The report also included migrant children reporting retaliation by officers, being forced to sleep on concrete, and being insulted by agents.
These cases are horrifying to us, but unfortunately, they are not coming as a surprise. I can tell you that they're very consistent with what our clients who have been held in CBP custody have told us over and over again.
That's Laura Belos, advocacy attorney with the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project, which represents migrant children after they've been released from Border Patrol custody. She spoke with our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
So I know we spoke with Golden McCarthy with your organization last month on the show, and she said that you were hearing from some of your clients that they are being held in substandard conditions for longer than the 72 hours required by law. Can you describe for us what you're hearing from these children?
Sure. We've represented a number of clients in complaints. For example, one client is a 17-year-old boy, and he told us that when he was in CBP custody, the agents wanted to put him into a very small room where there were about 130 other children already there. And there just wasn't room for him to fit. So he told us that in order to make room, agents went into that room and kicked children who were asleep on the floor awake so that way they would stand up and make more room. And our client told us that that night he slept sitting up because there just was not room to do anything else.
So the really explosive thing in this new story is about this accusation of sexual assault on a 15-year-old girl here at an Arizona facility that's now being investigated. Have you heard any allegations of sexual assault from any of the young women or young men that you have worked with?
I haven't heard any of allegations of that type specifically, but I can tell you that kids have reported verbal abuse. One of our clients has told us that agents said to him that he was one of the kids who was here to ruin the country. Kids have said that agents threw food at them instead of giving it to them when it was time to eat. I think that's the kind of treatment that our clients have said makes them feel like they were treated like animals. And that's just really, really concerning to us.
Any reports of retaliation like we are reading here?
Well, one of our clients told us that he was traveling with a much younger child who kept repeating requests to use the bathroom, and agents repeatedly ignored him. And then he had to sit in dirty pants and underwear for a number of hours. Those kinds of complaints are common.
So the Trump administration responded to the NBC story and said that these do not align with the practices at their facilities and they will be fully investigated. Have you gotten responses from the government and from agents when your clients report things like this?
We haven't received responses, to my knowledge, to the most recent complaints that we've filed.
And what are the complaints detailing? I mean, is there a pattern that you think is emerging here?
So, as I mentioned, there was a 17-year-old boy who reported physical abuse of other children. We've reported another client, a 13-year-old boy who was held in a room with the lights on 24 hours, so he couldn't tell if it was day or night. He said he was hungry because he was only fed twice a day, and each time it was just a small hamburger, that he was in an overcrowded room where there are only two bathrooms for more than 100 children. Kids have told us really consistently that they're very cold, that they're not able to get access to showers for a number of days. One of our clients is a 3-year-old girl who was separated from her family and was held in CBP custody for 14 days, and that's also really worrying.
So lastly then, Laura, I want to talk about what you think needs to change. I mean, a lot of this, I think, is being attributed to the fact that there is seemingly a crisis. There is overcrowding. The government has talked about that as well as a challenge for them. What do you think can be done if everyone is working in good faith to try to keep these children safe as they travel through the immigration system?
I think one of the most important things to start off with is oversight, and making sure that these complaints are voiced and that these kids have access to services and lawyers that can voice them for those children, and to make sure that these become public and that they're investigated. I think that's a really important first step. I mean, I think even if our clients are children without status or from another country, these are children and they deserve to be treated with protection and care. And that's what we do on a daily basis, is advocate for their rights and do our best to share their stories so that way we can encourage the government to be accountable and to follow the laws that are in place.
Laura, thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
That was Laura Belos, advocacy attorney with the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project, speaking with our co-host Lauren Gilger about the conditions for migrant children being held by immigration officials here in Arizona.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Governor Doug Ducey surprised most observers when he came out strongly against Nike's decision not to produce a special 4th of July shoe with what's known as the Betsy Ross flag on it. Ducey's tweets came on top of Goodyear's announcement that it reached an agreement with Nike to bring hundreds of jobs to the city. Days later, when Nike confirmed it was still coming to the Valley in spite of Ducey's comments, he issued an additional tweet with a welcoming message to the company. So where does Ducey fit into the broader national battle? Phil Boas, editorial director of the Arizona Republic, is with me for his weekly appearance to talk about the column he wrote about that topic. Phil, how does the Ducey and Nike situation fit with the bigger discussions we're hearing, including tweets by President Trump this weekend that many are calling racist?
Well, it was interesting to watch social media over the weekend because there was this sense on the left that we had crossed some Rubicon, that Donald Trump has shown without a doubt that he is a racist. Now, think of this. It's been 3 years since one of the top leaders in the Republican Party, Paul Ryan, then Speaker of the House, said that Trump had basically given the textbook definition of racism when he attacked a federal judge. That was 3 years ago, okay? What happened about 5 months after that? Trump got elected. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've crossed a Rubicon. I think we've known this about Trump for a long time. Is he racist? Something I've said to minorities, yes, he is racist. He's a vulgar man. He's obnoxious. There's no doubt about that. He attacked a Gold Star mother, for goodness sakes. He attacked a disabled man. He is that. And why should minorities think they're special? They get attacked too. He attacks everybody, his Republican opponents. He spared them nothing. He goes after everyone. It's a kind of human being he is.
I want to talk to you about Nike to some extent also. And someone, Colin Kaepernick, was a very easy target for Trump in the past when it came down to the players who would kneel during the national anthem, and that was blown into something, whether you're a patriot or not. How does all of that play into Trump's tactics and then what we're seeing even with Kaepernick speaking out about the Betsy Ross flag shoes?
Well, I think Kaepernick revealed something about himself with this latest burst of tweets and his complaint to Nike about the Betsy Ross flag shoes. He was really showing that he is part of American politics, which is the social justice left. The problem with the social justice left is they're attacking the fundamental ideals of the country. You know, the Betsy Ross flag is part of that. The Betsy Ross flag flew at a time when, you know, the Americans still practice slavery, and thus it's not fit for polite society. Well, that's silliness, and that has to be opposed. And Doug Ducey decided he would be the guy to oppose it and stand against it. And the problem is that Ducey isn't ready for that stage, and he's never proven here in Arizona that he's ready to go into that cauldron and be that very tough guy on a national stage. I don't see it in him, and it clearly was the wrong guy to do it.
There's a phrase you describe about Ducey about how when media ask him questions, you can tell that he's uncomfortable. He is seen by some as sort of a reactor to sort of figure out where are things going. Well, so this seems like he came out more than reacting.
Yeah. So a lot of the leftist media in Arizona is really unhinged about Ducey. They think he's an ideologue. They think he's a Trump acolyte. That's craziness. Doug Ducey is a technocrat, and he's an incrementalist. He's, you know, he's a guy, unlike Donald Trump, he has a lot of shame, and he's not comfortable in his own skin, and we see that in him. And consequently, we saw him kind of melt when it came time when he stood up against Nike, and then he very quickly retreated. I mean, the wearing Nike shoes so soon after that was a clear retreat, you know, that he couldn't stand against that.
You're a fan of Ducey. He won re-election very easily. What is his approach here then? Because as we've seen, talk about technocrat, yes, we're not used to him taking some stand. And this was a stand that had very little to do. He could have just let Goodyear do what Goodyear wanted to do.
I think he did it for national politics. I think maybe the people around him, maybe he himself, you know, aspire to much bigger things. But he hasn't shown us that he has the toughness, the intestinal fortitude to stand up against, you know, what is a pressure cooker in Washington to go to that level. You know, that kind of environment ate up Janet Napolitano when she first got there. And Napolitano was made of much sterner stuff. She had real steel in her backbone. And she got chewed up when she went to Washington. She immediately made a number of gaffes. All of Washington was making fun of her, you know. And it took a while for her to ride that out and to get used to it. But I can't even imagine Ducey in that pressure cooker. I can't see it.
Do you think this affects in any way, knowing he's not running for re-election again for governor, does this affect Ducey's popularity in any way that matters?
I think it hurts him a little bit. I think to raise the white flag so quickly just looked weak, and I feel badly for him. I didn't write that column out of anger that he had pulled back. I think he was choosing a good cause. It's a worthy cause to stand against the social justice warriors who are really out of control.
All right, Phil Boas, thanks.
Thanks.
Phil Boas is editorial director of the Arizona Republic.
A court ruling in Europe this week could have major global implications. That's one of the big international stories of the coming days. And with me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rich Preston. And Rich, tomorrow we're expecting a ruling in a court case between Russia and Ukraine taking place in the Netherlands. What exactly is this about?
Yes, Mark, this is all about a collection of gold jewellery from Crimea, thousands of years old. It's called the Scythian gold. Now, this is interesting because it shows some of the smaller consequences of major global events. Now, this gold, Mark, was on loan from four Crimean museums to a museum in the Netherlands back in 2014. And then Russia annexed Crimea. And when the loan period was up and the treasure was due to be returned, Ukraine said, no, it can't go back to Crimea because Crimea is now in the hands of Russia. And at the time the gold was borrowed, it belonged to Ukraine. So this is really all about who owns the cultural artifacts of Crimea: Ukraine, the current administration in Crimea, or Russia. Now, the court in Amsterdam had originally found that the gold can only go back to a sovereign nation, which Crimea isn't, so therefore it should go back to Ukraine. But the museums in Crimea appealed that ruling, and the decision in that appeal is due tomorrow.
Now, Rich, Russia, Crimea, and Ukraine all obviously have something at stake here, but this is kind of sensitive for the Dutch too, right?
Yes. Now, you may remember that when Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine several years ago, it had many Dutch passengers on board. Now, Dutch investigators say they're confident the flight was shot down by a Russian-made rocket being fired by Russian-backed separatists. Russia has reportedly threatened to cut cultural ties with the Netherlands if the gold doesn't go back to Crimea. So that ruling about a relatively small subject, but with potentially big ripples, due tomorrow.
And as you mentioned, that ruling coming tomorrow. The following day, on Wednesday, we'll see a record-setting moment for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He'll become Israel's longest-serving prime minister, but not all smooth sailing there.
No, the record's currently held, by the way, by David Ben-Gurion, the country's first leader, in 1948. But Mr. Netanyahu won an election earlier this year, allowing him to stay in office, and on Wednesday will become the new record holder. Now, it really is noteworthy, an achievement of this kind in Israeli politics. The parliamentary system there means that coalitions of several parties are needed to form a government, and often smaller parties can withdraw their support and force new elections. So to stay in power this long really is remarkable. But, and there is a but, although that election earlier this year was a definite win for Mr. Netanyahu, he wasn't able to form a government. And that means Israel is heading back into election campaigning mode. In the meantime, there's tension in the region between the US and Iran, as we know, and the US has begun talking about the so-called deal of the century, which we've discussed before, Mark, to restart negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians.
There's also the issue that Mr. Netanyahu is still facing legal problems.
Yes, Israel's attorney general informed him in February that he intended to indict him on charges of bribery, fraud and breach of trust in connection with three cases pending a final hearing that will happen after the elections. Mr. Netanyahu's wife also recently struck a deal with prosecutors over a complicated case involving misuse of state funds. So despite breaking this record, there are lots of things on Mr. Netanyahu's plate and lots of issues that could potentially see the next election go in someone else's favour.
And Rich, finally today, a week from today, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan will be in Washington, D.C. It'll be his first meeting with President Trump. And there's talk that this meeting could lead the two countries to reinvigorate their relationship, right?
Yes, now both of them talk about being long-term friends, Mark, but that relationship's been tested recently. Last year, President Trump cancelled $300 million in aid to Pakistan, saying it wasn't being tough enough on terrorism. And when India and Pakistan came close to open conflict over a terror attack earlier this year, the Trump administration seemed to side with India. But at the same time, the US wants Pakistan to help come up with some kind of workable peace deal in Afghanistan.
And there's also China in the mix as well.
Yes, and that inevitably complicates things. The US wants to build a regional balance to China's influence, and that means a political alliance of sorts with India. That's pushed Pakistan into turning more towards China for investment. But at the same time, President Trump says he's not happy with India's trade deals. He's called it the king of tariffs. And there's talk that India and the US could be heading for a trade war akin to what's happening with China. So plenty for President Trump and Imran Khan to talk about when they meet next week.
All right. That is the BBC's Rich Preston. Rich, as always, really good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
It's a problem nonprofits face after they see donors in the headlines for the wrong reasons. In this case, a University of Arizona foundation received $50,000 from Gratitude America in 2017. The nonprofit supports military veterans and their families affected by brain injuries or combat-related stress. MIT also received $150,000 from Gratitude America. The rub is that the former president of that nonprofit is Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire accused of sex trafficking teenage girls. Harvard had previously received $6.5 million from Epstein and won't be giving it back. So in these circumstances, what's a university or nonprofit to do? Joining us for a few minutes is Mary Feeney, professor and Lincoln Professor of Ethics in Public Affairs at Arizona State University, who's with us from Washington, D.C. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
What are your initial thoughts when it comes to this sort of thing? We have, especially if it happens, let's say a decade or so later, that we find out new information about someone who has donated. What sort of pressure does that put on a nonprofit in terms of what decision they should make next?
Well, so nonprofits, a lot of nonprofits will have policies of how they deal with donations to begin with, right? They might have some set up rules to move forward. But one of the first things to sort of recognize is once a donation's made, the money no longer belongs to the donor. It belongs to the nonprofit. And so the longer the nonprofit has that money, say it's 10 years down the road, it's really difficult to sort of return money. Typically, nonprofits will approach to this with the first decision of is the money legal, right? So when the money was found, if it was given to the nonprofit illegally, if it was the result of some sort of embezzlement or tax fraud, there can be a lot of state regulations that then come into effect and require the nonprofit to give the money back. When the case is that the money was acquired legally and given legally, then we get into these moral, ethical grounds where it can be a little grayer for nonprofits to figure out when they should give the money back or not.
Just how much vetting is typically done when it comes to this, especially a donation that may be $6 million, for example?
Well, a donation that large would have a lot more vetting that goes behind it, but also universities, which tend to have foundations, which are processing large gifts over time and acquiring large amounts of money, will have a pretty formal process for how they vet donors. In some of these cases, we're also talking about the difference between a donation from an organization for which a person may, someone like Epstein may belong to, versus an individual donation from an individual person, right? So the vetting would be different in those cases.
In those situations where it's not so much a legal issue but more of a moral, ethical issue, how do those conversations tend to go, and what's sort of the decision-making process in terms of what to do about that money?
Well, so there's sort of three things a nonprofit can do. They can keep the money and keep the name of the person on a building, or keep the sort of program that the funding was used for, in particular if the funding was earmarked for some particular use, like a scholarship fund or naming a building or an endowed chair for a professor in the case of universities. The second option is to just return the money, remove the name, remove the endowment, end the program. These decisions would be made sort of depending on the timing of the money. In some cases, donations are pledged, some donations are ongoing, and some donations they're sort of closed. They happened a long time ago, the money's been spent, the money's gone. And then the third approach that a university, and I think that most organizations would probably take, is this compromised approach, where you may give some of the funding back, you may not give any of the funding back, but you would remove the donor's name from a building or from a program. These compromised situations tend to be sort of complicated decisions that are best handled in a transparent sort of way and would depend a lot on the organization's mission and the stakeholders. Would giving back the money hurt the people that the organization is sort of aiming to help with the funding? Would keeping the money reduce legitimacy and accountability for the organization? Would returning the money sort of be a real visible way of addressing some inequality? And so these compromise situations will balance a lot of these other sort of issues that the nonprofit is dealing with.
And briefly, now we're in a situation that's maybe different for private versus public universities, but as many public universities around the country have gotten less traditional state funding, is there a different kind of pressure that comes to universities now? There's maybe a little bit more of a need for the money, but there still has to be that proper vetting.
Oh, that's a really complicated question. I think, yes, universities are under pressure and they need more money, but I mean, it's true that all nonprofits need funding to achieve their missions and their goals, and they have to balance these sort of demands for the stakeholders and the people they're trying to serve and maybe the victims of the donor, right? And so does keeping the money hurt the mission of the organization? Then it's probably not worth doing. And so while these organizations are challenged to find financial resources, at the same time, they're mission-driven organizations that are trying to embody some set of values to achieve a public outcome. And that has to really be more important than, I think, the race for funds.
All right. That is Mary Feeney, Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Public Affairs at ASU. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Make sure to stay tuned at 10 o'clock this morning for The Takeaway. The monsoon season is here. Storms hopefully will be rolling in at some point. Whether you love them or hate them, we learned last year that everyone has a monsoon story. So we're bringing our series Monsoon Stories back this summer, and we need your help. This time around, we're telling stories about how the monsoon storms tickle our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and even taste. If you'd like to join in, there are plenty of ways you can participate. Just go to the monsoon.kjzz.org website, find out how to tell us your story, or send us the best monsoon photo you've captured. Your story could end up on the air. Your photo could be featured on our website.
The world of work is rapidly changing thanks to technological advances, and the shift is on the cusp of becoming even more dramatic. Automation and AI are causing many Americans to wonder how much longer their jobs will last and how much new learning they're going to have to do to keep a post. New America has done an analysis of a few cities to gauge what may be next in employment. It's called Automation Nation, three cities preparing for the future of work. Phoenix is one of the cities, along with Indianapolis and South Bend, Indiana. Molly Martin was involved with the report. She's the director of New America in Indianapolis. We began by talking about the unique challenges each city, including Phoenix, faces when it comes to automation.
Phoenix has a little more momentum and youthful energy on its side. And I'm not just talking about population, although you do have a lot of new population. In the Midwest, we don't have as much in migration. But you also have some younger industries, you have more innovation-related economy, and you have less of a manufacturing economy. So that's the biggest difference. And the automation challenges for an innovation-centered economy and a manufacturing economy are different.
When a place like Phoenix grows as quickly as it does, and you have so many people thinking they're going to get an opportunity there, how important is it to have as close to an equal opportunity as possible, meaning that we can't just focus on the high-paying jobs because perhaps those will be a little bit safer from automation than the lower-paying ones?
That's exactly right. We actually need to focus a lot of our design energy on pathways into solid entry-level work and also pathways kind of laterally from the lowest paid work right now, pathways to grow and kind of be flexible and adaptable for folks who are getting paid the least now. The people who make the least money and the people who have the least education after high school are the people who are going to be most rocked and disrupted by, we sometimes say job loss, but what we really mean is task changes in a job, disruption by automation. And we want to make sure those folks have someplace to go, not just because it's the right thing to do, and it is, but because it's also really economically smart. We don't want large groups of people in our cities without a way to contribute, a way to be happy, a way to find a home, and a pathway to opportunity. And to your point, the people who are earning a decent living now and have more of their tasks less automatable in those more kind of future-proof jobs. I won't say they're all going to be okay. We're all going to be affected by this, and we will find a way, but they just aren't as much in the crosshairs.
So how much responsibility lies with a community? Is there sort of the combination of a community saying, we know that this could be an issue, so we're going to help offer you things, but you have to take the bull by the horns yourself once we do that?
It is our job as a community to make sure our workers, our residents, our neighbors know that this is a real threat, but they do. We know from our work and others' work that the most vulnerable workers, the lowest paid residents, people in jobs that are especially vulnerable, cashiers, hospitality workers who are paid the least, even some folks in accounting, they know the technology is changing their jobs because it already has. And they also hear the news, read the news, and know what's coming. It's actually the folks they're working for who don't always have a clear message that it's of what they're going to do about it. They say, you know, I feel a little uneasy. And the employers may say, it's fine, which is kind of an inadequate answer because there is a realistic shift we're going to have to make. Yes, we need people to take some initiative in re-education, reskilling, although I don't love those words because it kind of indicates there's something wrong with you now, and there's not. But there are new opportunities to kind of remain adaptable and flexible and always be learning, which we're all going to have to do regardless of our jobs. But there really is a huge onus on the employer and the community to build new ways that people can get these skills, be aware of the risk, ways we can kind of reach out to folks and aggregate the opportunity and the demand where people are, because our residents, especially the most vulnerable people who aren't earning as much, but who are really making our communities run, they don't have time to stop everything and find the right childcare and get the transportation to take extra courses. And they do have some online learning opportunities and unique learning opportunities, especially in a place like Phoenix. But the employers and the community are going to have to find even more ways that people can learn in place, earn certifications and credentials for what they're working on, earn those things at work, and earn them in a way that's cost effective. So it really is on all of us.
Is there a real risk of increase in the have and have not situation as technology brings some along and leaves others by the curb?
Sure. And it's already happening to most places, and Phoenix is no exception. In our analysis of Phoenix, and it's a pretty common picture, we find that just one over three jobs in the Phoenix metro is at particularly high risk, and that's just over 649,000 jobs. we have another 537,000 jobs that are at risk. And what we mean when we say at risk is that they could be disrupted, they could go away or change significantly enough that the people who currently hold them can't find those same opportunities anymore. What we mean when we say at risk is that the number of tasks that make up that job, a significant share of those tasks can be automated. The more emotionless, rote tasks that make up a job, the higher the percentage of automation potential within that job. Phoenix has a lot of people working in retail and working in food service. A lot of those people are women. A lot of those people are people of color, especially Latino. And you already have a big gap, especially in the median earnings for Latinos versus white people living in Phoenix. And that gap's just going to get larger if more people are competing for these lowest paid jobs and you aren't designing to make sure that your Latino residents who don't have post-secondary attainment, if they don't, aren't being given the same opportunities so that they can compete for other jobs. If you have low-income white residents who don't have some of the skills they need, we aren't seeing a lot of design in any city. Common problem. South Bend, Indy have the same problems for women. So women are being kind of left out of the automation redeployment conversation. So what will happen is you'll end up with a lot of people with that kind of broken social contract and a lot of people unable to spend their money in your community, thrive in your community, or maybe cobbling together a living from a variety of sources, which can be good, but no city really currently has a perfect infrastructure of healthcare benefits and childcare and transit that makes it possible for people to have the kind of livable, mobile life that I think all of you in Phoenix would want your neighbors to have.
Molly Martin is director of New America in Indianapolis. We've been talking about the report Automation Nation, Three Cities Preparing for the Future of Work.
Groundwater pumping has caused some streams up to half of their flows. That's according to new research from the University of Arizona and the Colorado School of Mines. Laura Condon helped author the paper on this. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the U of A, and she joins me. And Laura, this seems to show pretty significant impacts of groundwater pumping in the U.S. over the last 100 years.
Yeah, so what we did, we started from a USGS study of the total amount of groundwater that's been depleted in the U.S. So they estimate that's about 800 cubic kilometers, which for reference is about 20 times the size of Lake Mead, the largest reservoir in the U.S. So we've lost a huge amount of storage in the subsurface over the last 100 years. And the question of our study was really, okay, what does this mean for hydrology and how have we reshaped our landscape by losing all of this storage in the subsurface?
Well, what have the impacts been that you found?
So what we show is that when you take all this water out of the subsurface, it actually has big impacts on the surface. So we see losses in stream flow, especially in places like the Great Plains and the Colorado River Basin. We can see declines of 10 to 50% as a result of this storage loss. And we see some loss of small tributaries completely. And then we also see decreased plant water availability. So as we lower the groundwater, that impacts soil moisture and makes decreases the amount of water that's available to plants.
Does it also impact the ability of the land to absorb water when it actually rains?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So as we lower the groundwater tables, we can change the amount of water that will be recharged when rain does fall. So actually, we can induce more recharge when we have lower groundwater tables.
So in that sense, it sounds like the groundwater pumping may actually be a bit of a benefit. Am I hearing that right?
Well, it depends. It depends what side of the coin you're looking at. So when we lower the groundwater, that means we're going to be sucking more water into the subsurface. That's why we end up losing stream flow, because we have streams that are now contributing to groundwater as opposed to the opposite, where we might have groundwater that was discharging to streams. So we are going to gain storage in the subsurface as it tries to recover from those losses, but we might not really see that water unless we're pumping it.
The impacts that you found, do they tend to be long-term or shorter-term? Like, how long after the groundwater has been pumped out do you tend to start seeing some of these impacts?
Yeah, so that's a really important thing about groundwater is groundwater is the slowest moving component of our terrestrial water cycle. So that's really important because it means that groundwater can help buffer out wet and dry periods and wet and dry years. So for example, in periods where we have not so much precipitation, a lot of times our stream flow is supported by base flow from groundwater that was actually recharged a long time ago. So groundwater is the slow moving part of our system, which means that when we have things like storage losses that are occurring over 100 years, it's going to take a long time to actually rebound from those storage losses. And for starters, we'd have to stop pumping if we wanted to really rebound on those. So what we see are really long-lasting impacts. But you could also see impacts, initial impacts from groundwater pumping that happen really immediately. For example, if you're pumping nearby a stream, you can start seeing impacts right away.
One of the other issues that, especially here in Arizona, we've noticed from groundwater pumping, that's been attributed to groundwater pumping anyway, is the issue of subsidence and, the earth sort of sinking in. Is that how big of a concern is that? And is that a concern in other parts of the country as well, in addition to just here in Arizona?
Yeah, so we didn't study subsidence as part of this study specifically, but subsidence is definitely a big concern when we have storage losses. So when you have the subsurface that is saturated with water, that means we have water filling those pores. When you take that water out, then the subsurface is going to compact because we don't have water holding things up anymore. So that's a problem at the land surface. We can have like infrastructure problems because we have a land surface that's dropping. But it can actually also be a problem for future recharge because we don't actually have that pore space anymore to store water in because the subsurface has compacted. So it's kind of a twofold problem.
As the consciousness sort of increases about the use of water and the scarcity of water, how do you hope that research like this is used by both policymakers and, regular citizens who, we all use water?
Yeah. So I think the message from this work and what we're trying to highlight with this research is that groundwater and surface water are connected resources. And this would not really be news to a hydrologist. We've known for a long time that if you pump, you can impact streams, you can impact riparian vegetation. But really the point of this study and doing it across the U.S. at a really large scale was to show just how widespread all of these storage changes are and how widespread the impacts to the land surface can be. So I think a lot of times when we're figuring out policy, we're thinking about, what does sustainability mean in terms of how much can we pump and not run out of water in our aquifers? But we also have to think of groundwater as providing a really critical resource to the land surface and interacting with the land surface. So we need to think about not just are we going to run out of groundwater or not, but are we decreasing our groundwater levels to the point where we're losing some of that buffering that groundwater could provide to the land surface.
All right, that's Laura Condon, an assistant professor in the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Pop music has been used as a vehicle of political protest for years. And in Mexico, many musicians use their tunes and fame as a platform to criticize social problems, including border tensions and the struggles that migrants face. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
Bob Dylan, Public Enemy, Rage Against the Machine, all of them are examples of musicians that brought us songs of uprising, anthems of an era. And Mexico has its own slice of history, especially since the 90s, when the state relaxed its policies to restrain rock.
My name is Randy Ebright. I do not much.
Randy's being modest. He's a songwriter, drummer, vocalist, and guitar player from the Mexican band Molotov, which formed in the 90s, shortly after he moved from the U.S. to Mexico.
When I was 15 years old, my family got transferred down here. My father was a DEA agent.
Molotov's popularity comes from its mix of hip-hop with rock, but also from its irreverent, sometimes anti-establishment lyrics in Spanglish. Immigration became a topic after Randy's baby daughter, born in Mexico, was inspected by customs agents in a U.S. airport.
Checking her diaper to see if she had any, contraband. And
the experience was an eye-opener for Randy on the mistreatment towards immigrants, and he came up with the song Frijolero.
Now I wish I had a dime for every single time I've gotten stared down for being in the wrong side of town. In a rich man I'd be if I had that kind of chips. Lately I want to smack the mouths of these racists.
Randy says the song contrasts the way he felt welcomed in Mexico, unlike the welcome many immigrants get in the U.S. He reflected on the issue again with the song Dreamers, about undocumented Mexican youth living in the U.S. He played it at MTV Unplugged.
I'm also a dreamer, you know. I ended up living the Mexican dream.
The Mexican government currently deports thousands of Central Americans as a result from a tariff threat from Washington. Randy says Mexico and the U.S. are now playing the same game.
I think it's pretty sad. It's kind of hypocritical.
And another group that's been close to immigration issues is the eclectic band Café Tacuba.
One of our priorities for sure is to try to reflect what is around us and talk about it.
That's Emmanuel del Real, or Meme, a multi-instrumentalist from Café Tacuba. Along with singer Rubén Albarrán, he visited the migrant caravan shelter in Mexico City last year.
For me, it was a lesson to see.
Meme says he was surprised to see the positive attitude from migrants despite their situation. They decided to play some tunes to the travelers, including Olita del Alta Mar. Here's a fragment from their NPR's Tiny Desk appearance. El Fin de la Infancia, The End of Childhood, is another song Meme considers a portrait of the migrant struggle.
And the song says we don't have to see what's going on in New York to be ourselves.
Meme says immigrants are not fully recognized as part of the American social fabric, but humanity is a blend of cultures and migrations will never stop. Joaquin Rosendo is a musician and producer. He performs in the underground Mexican scene as a masked character called Vetiver Bong.
It's a wrestler that play cumbia in the night.
Vetiver Bong's song, Mexican Robots, is a ode to migrant workers in the U.S.
We are the Mexican robots to clean your house, to work in the restaurants, I don't know. And they're fighting for the American dream.
Rosendo did arrangements for the latest album of Mexican-American singer Lila Downs.
The idea of the new record of Lila is to talk about Oaxaca and borders.
Downs sings a cover to Manu Chao's Clandestino, which lyrics refer to the hard times undocumented migrants face. And just like Randy and Meme, Rosendo hopes that new generations keep raising their voices on issues that affect them. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
To learn more about the protest rock scene in Mexico and fully hear the featured songs in this story, visit KJZZ.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.